We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts a bad taste, and our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in this room tonight will hear our speaker, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I am one of them too, and I must have this thing. And tonight we have Lyle P. From the Stockbridge Group. He's coming to share his powerful story. He was introduced by Bill Sanders when I heard him last fall. He said he was the only person that Bill Sanders had met that had an FUI. But I can tell you our singer tonight, he also had one. But we'll talk about that another time. But this also happens to be 21 years tonight. So without any further delay, I'll give you Lyle P.
Good evening. My name is Lyle. I am an alcoholic. Good to be here with everybody tonight. Good to be here sober. So it's not the case 21 years ago right this minute. During the setup for all of this, somebody said, you know, keep this to 45 minutes. So I need to tell you right now that I'm not going to be able to do that. And I've done this a lot of times, and I know about what it takes. I guess I could do it. I come up and tell you, well, what it was like was I really drank a heck of a lot and got in trouble. And what happened was I went to treatment and got involved in AA and got sober. And what it's like is that life's really good today. But in the event we have newcomers here, they probably want to hear a little bit more than that. So I'm going to do my best to do that in the most respectful way possible. I want to say that, you know, that if occasionally I'm at some speaker meeting where it becomes imperative that the meeting start on the hour and that it end on the hour. And my feeling about that is when the clock begins to override what we're really supposed to be doing here and takes precedence over that, then I question the authenticity of our genuine effort in that regard. And the other thing, of course, that I think about is I didn't drink like that. I never went into a bar and said, okay, hands on them, set me up, and I got 60 minutes here, and when it's over, I got to go home. I didn't do that. As a matter of fact, I thought more than taking a clock with me, I probably ought to just take a calendar. That would be better. So, you know, I really want to try to be timely about this, and nobody wants to sit here and listen to some speaker go on and on and on and on. And hopefully I won't do that. But if you're one of those folks that you really need to get out of here when the hand hits the 12 again, please feel free to do that. I will not be offended. I'm not going to burst into tears at the podium. I'm not going to stop in the bar and way home and get a drink. So if you need to leave, please feel free. But I'm going to do the best I can to fulfill the purpose that I came here for, and that is, you know, it was so important to me when I was new in treatment. And I'll get into the story. But I wanted desperately to believe what I was learning in treatment. I wanted to believe that big book. I wanted to believe the counselors and the doctors and the people around me. And I was really investing in this thing because I didn't have any more choices in front of me. And I really, really wanted this thing badly. But it was really only when I saw speakers go up there and talk about this and go through this whole process that I had firsthand, up close, three-dimensional, living evidence and proof that what they were telling me was true and it really worked. And if I had only seen one or six or a dozen speakers, I would have still thought, well, yes, out of 100,000 alcoholics, what are the chances? But what I got to see was the consistency of this program and the results that came from it. And so my faith and my confidence was really cemented because I said, you know, it's not just a theory. This is not just something that's written in a book. This actually works. And here are the people in front of me who are telling me and showing me that it in fact works. So I think it's important that while I not go on and on and on and on, I also don't skip through this thing just so that I can get out of here and go home. Every year when March 7th, 8th, and 9th roll around, it's intense for me. And that began 21 years ago right now. Because 21 years ago right now, I was in a place called the Speakeasy Restaurant Lounge in Fargo, North Dakota. And what I didn't know 21 years ago at this very moment was that I was putting in play some events and circumstances that were going to absolutely rip around through this nation and the media and the world and change my life. On March the 8th, about 12 hours from right now, an event took place in the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport where three pilots were arrested after having just landed or flying drunk. I was the captain of that crew. Now, I try to make it clear, when I talk about the airline pilot aspect of this, that's only done for story purposes and for story purposes only. If I had been anything other than an airline pilot, if I'd been a doctor, a lawyer, if I'd been a plumber, electrician, construction worker, self-employed, none of the fallout would have been what it was. Would never have made the news. But because I was an airline pilot, it made the news. I was the first airline pilot ever arrested, tried, convicted, and sent to prison for flying drunk. Now, that's happened a bunch of times since then. But they don't make the news very long. They're on one or two nights, and it disappears, and I don't see or hear any more about it. But because ours was the first situation, it made the news and it stayed on for weeks and weeks and weeks. And I found myself thinking, I don't know that Pearl Harbor got this kind of coverage. And I didn't think it was ever going to go away. And every time it came on, it was just like somebody stuck a red hot poker right through my intestines. I was just sick. We were detained for 12 hours on March the 8th. And I knew when I walked off the airplane and I immediately saw two airport policemen, I saw FAA officials, and I saw Northwest Airlines officials that life was over, that this was the end of it. Northwest Airlines at that time was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. All the other major carriers had those programs, and they dated back to the mid-70s when they first came into play. And the other airlines had extraordinarily successful programs, not because they're dealing with airline pilots, nothing special about airline pilots, but it was a very complex, long-term, two-year, then went to three-year monitoring process and program. A lot of people involved, peer monitors, doctors, FAA officials, a lot of accountability, so the success rate was pretty high. And we had this thing that most of us who were pilots, you know, the only thing worse than losing our career would be if our family was killed in a common accident. Anything else was not that bad on a relative scale. You know, my feeling has always been, and hopefully always will be, that it doesn't make any difference what you do for a living. I've known people that run the entire spectrum and gamut. I've known some Fortune 500 CEOs, millionaires that were recovering. I've known people who have just struggled out from underneath a bridge in a cardboard condo. And my view of this thing and this fellowship is that we share one thing, and there's only one level of achievement in this fellowship, and that is called getting sober. And when we do that, that's the one thing here, the great common denominator that makes us all the same and all equal. That none of the other stuff matters. It really doesn't. And I've maintained that position for a long time, and I will until I get an email saying that we just broke ground on the A Hall of Fame. And although I've been some places where I've seen some people that were alleged A celebrities, and I find it very distasteful, and I just don't join in on any of that. So I'm going to talk about being a pilot, but it's only because that's what drove the story. We were detained for about 12 hours that day on March the 8th, saw various sets of attorneys for the Airline Pilots Association and the company. We're finally deposed by company attorneys, gave sworn statements. Blood at two facilities, and it was at one of those facilities where a reporter saw three uniformed pilots and two uniformed cops and thought there was a story there. Now, from the moment that I walked off the airplane and I saw this, the one overwhelming instant feeling I had was one of shame and disgrace. Instantly. And it went all the way through. And it hit my bone marrow. And I've seen pilots at Northwest get terminated every 2, 3, 4, 6 years. Somebody get in trouble drinking, it would reach the company's attention, and they were swiftly, permanently terminated. It ripped through the airline like wildfire. I knew the names. I knew the locations. And all of us had what I considered a little hall of shame up here in our brain housing group. And I one of the tumbling thoughts I had that day was, that's where my name goes. And I had not lived my life in such a way as to try to leave that as a legacy. I think one of the reasons I had so much shame was that I'd been the guy in my family, as I was raising my kids, who always talked about things like duty, honor, country. Character, honesty, integrity. Do the right thing. And in the aftermath of what I had just done, all of that was hollow and meaningless. And I thought, you know, it has no value to my kids. Look what I've done, and look where I'm headed. I'm going to be a national disgrace. I didn't know it at the time until it made the media, that I'm going to be a disgrace, and I'm going to leave the airline in disgrace. I'm going to talk about two parents who were alcoholics and who died from this disease, but I never go to the podium without thanking my parents for the good things they gave me during the times they were sober. They gave me some DNA that's got some genetic predisposition for alcohol, but they gave me some DNA that's pretty good. And I owe my parents. I'm indebted to my parents for the good stuff they gave me. And they always told me to do my best, you know, no matter what it was. There was nothing too menial, nothing too below me, but what I should always, always, always do my best and try to do it better than you did. And then I should leave whatever it was that I was doing bright and shiny, polished with some dignity on it. And in the aftermath of what I had just done that night in Fargo, commencing 21 years ago right this minute, I ashamed and disgraced everything that had any value to me. And I had a hard time with that. A really, really hard time. It was only going to get worse in the days ahead. I got back to a commuter apartment that night after the arrest, and suddenly, for the first time that day, it dawned on me I was supposed to be home that evening. The trauma had been so great I hadn't even thought about that. And I called my home, and my wife didn't answer. She spent 4 hours out here at the Atlanta airport, 4 hours sitting out there waiting on me to come in, and was gone. And when the answering machine picked up and I heard my voice, I didn't know what to say. And it was a very defeated message that there had been a disaster, and I thought I'd lost my job and I'd be at home in the first flight in the morning. I'll never know why she didn't call me back after having just received a message like that, but I later saw it as a huge gift. I don't know why she didn't return a call like that. And I was so sick, I just didn't want to talk about it. I got home the next morning on the first flight. I knew it was the last time I'd ever wear that uniform, ever. And I exited the airport very quickly. I knew everybody that worked out there for Northwest. I knew the mechanics and the baggage handlers and the groomers. I knew everybody. And we used to sit around and talk and laugh and joke. And I didn't want anybody to see me or stop me or say anything to me. And when I got to the front of the airport, I looked over and I saw my wife parked. And I've never told a story, but what I haven't said, that I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. She and I had been married a long time, and I couldn't look at her. And all I could say as she pulled away was, "Honey, I'm so sorry." And she had every right to have said to me, "Why were you there? What were you doing? You knew the Northwest rules. You've seen this before. Why did you stay? Why didn't you just have your drinks and go?" She didn't say a word. She got a very soft South Texas voice. And as she pulled away, she said, "Who better than I can possibly understand how you feel right now?" And again, we drove home in silence, and again, that was a gift. I don't know why she didn't question me. I just lost a 22-year golden career, and we drove home in silence. She went to work. I went inside the house, and I was just sick at heart. I didn't want to be in my skin. And within minutes, I picked the phone up and I called a doctor. He's a PhD doctor. He's a family therapist. And he gets involved in the story here in a little while. But he was the only guy I knew to call. And I said, I've just had an emergency and I need to come see you. He said, come straight in. So I drove over there, and it's just like it happened moments ago. I can still see the office and the setup and color of the walls. And I walked in, and I guess the good thing about when we reach the point when we're completely, totally, absolutely defeated, there's no more cutesy stuff. So I told him straight out what had happened, and I saw the look of shock on his face and surprise. And he said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. He says, it's absolutely horrible. He started around his desk. This is now Friday, March the 9th. And there'd be two statements I'd hear that day that my mind just couldn't get around to. I just couldn't figure. I didn't even try to process them. And I heard the first one then because he stopped and he looked at me. And he said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I didn't know why he said that to me or what he meant by that, why he would say that to me. A few minutes later, he came in. He said, I've just set you up for an appointment at 6 o'clock tonight. Now, that registered. This is a Friday night. Doctors don't see patients at 6 o'clock on Fridays. I know that. He said, this is a very prominent doctor on the other side of Atlanta. And he said, he's a psychiatrist. He's a recovering alcoholic, cocaine addict. And he's certified in addiction medicine. I had never, ever heard of addiction medicine. And later, when I asked him about that appointment time, he said, I got to tell you, he said, based on your appearance, I was afraid you were suicide. And I thought, I don't know what I look like. I do know what I felt like. I do know that I was nudging up close to the edge on that. And he saw it. Barbara and I drove across Atlanta following the directions to this doctor's office. And it was dark. And we went in, and she stayed in the waiting area. We went to an office, and I have no recollection of that meeting. It's just like an alcoholic blackout. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days. And I just couldn't get anything down. And I have no idea what he said to me or the quest list of questions he went over, anything. Except I know that at some point, but I gave him straight answers. I gave him honest answers as best I could. He looked at me and said, well, you're an alcoholic. You need to get in treatment tonight. And I said, I thought you'd probably tell me that. And I said, I'm okay with going into treatment. But I said, I just got home tonight. I said, please let me go home. I said, I'd like for Barbara to just hang on to me and let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened to me. I said, then I'll go into treatment. He said, you need to go into treatment tonight. I said, okay. I think of the 24 hours in some way that I'll never understand. I knew that I was an alcoholic. I knew he was going to tell me that because all of the reasons I had for never being an alcoholic no longer existed. And I'd lost my entire life because I went to a bar and I didn't intend to stay there. I didn't intend to drink and make the headlines and lose my career. That wasn't my intention when I went in there. But when I start to drink, I have a reason, always have a reason to stay. And I either close up the bar or I finish the bottle. And somehow, some way, I knew what I was. I've hated that word ever since I had seen it applied to people and knew what it meant. I hated that word. I hated that word since I saw what it did to my parents. I hated that word since I saw what it did to my native community. I hated that word. I saw people in the doorways and the alleyways of cities I'd flown into, laying on park benches. They were life's losers. They weren't an airline captain. You know, I didn't beat or abuse my wife or my kids. I drank in the morning maybe 3 times out of the year. I was convinced I was not an alcoholic, never going to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to be like the people that I identify as alcoholics. But I'll tell you what I had. I had a very thin picture of what an alcoholic was. I didn't really know. I thought I knew, but I didn't. I'm not going to do a big drunk log tonight because I don't have time. But I can tell you that when I got into treatment, I learned there's a difference between watching someone who's an alcoholic and actually starting to learn about the disease. And as they went through the disease, and I sat there with an open mind, every symptom they came up with was mine. Nobody was telling me, you're an alcoholic. I sat there and I listened. And no matter how much I didn't want to believe it, everything they said applied to me. And I'd lay there in bed and I think, it all fits. It all belongs to me. I cannot deny this. And so I knew. As we made our way back to the place called Anchor Hospital, following this set of directions, we made the final turn. It was dark, and the headlights swept the sign. As I made that turn, the sign is not there now. But when I saw the sign and the headlights, I hit the brakes and stopped, and the lights were on the sign directly in front of me. It said, Anchor Hospital, Hospital for Alcoholism and Other Chemical Dependencies. And I sat and looked at the sign, and it was like somebody just kicked me right in the guts. And I thought, how did I end up here? This is the last place on the face of the planet I thought I would ever be, in a treatment center for alcoholics. And just very quickly, within seconds, or maybe even less than that, I flashed back to the trail in my life and the trajectory I thought I had been on, and the really big things and the neat things that I'd accomplished that I was so incredibly proud of, most of them against the odds. And they didn't exist anymore. I wasn't even sure if they had ever been there. I remember sitting there completely empty, feeling as though I had no value as a human being. None. A few years later, I read a summarizing paragraph written by one of the doctors in that treatment center who had treated me. That paragraph said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society. And I remember thinking, my God, that's pretty brutal, pretty dismal. And my second thought was, well, I was the one that gave him all the information. And we started down the hill, and for the first time that day, I thought, this is March the 9th. I thought, this is my 27th wedding anniversary. And I said, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? And I heard the second thing that night, that day, that I couldn't fathom. Very softly, my wife said, might be the best one we ever had. And I thought, who could think that right now? Who could even imagine such a thing like that right now? And she was right. Let me lighten this up a little bit and tell you that a couple of years ago, March and I rolled around, and one of my sponsees pulled up in the driveway, surprised us. He said, I've heard the story. I know it's March the 9th. It's your anniversary. And he said, I just thought I'd come by and wish you happy anniversary. I said, come on in. Let's have some coffee. So we went in, and he's all bubbly. Well, 45 years at that time. He said, wow. He said, well, what's the secret to having stayed married so long? Before I had a chance to say anything, Barbara said, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. And, you know, I've never considered her a master of the one-liner. That's just not her style. But at one point in time, every time I turned on A&E or Discovery Channel, they had a film clip in there about alcohol and drugs in the transportation industry. And they will always seize on one little clip. I don't care if it's me, Michael Jackson, or somebody. They'll film 3 miles of it, and they'll put one little, the same clip. Whether it's Clinton and Monica and the Rose Garden, you see it over and over and over. So they had one of me. And it was me and Barbara and my attorney walking into the courthouse with the other two attorneys and their clients behind them. And I saw that, and I said something to Barbara. I said, you know, that's, I said, I've come a long way, and I've healed a lot. But I said, that's still painful for me to watch that. And she said, yeah, it is for me, too. And I said, really? Because she'd never said that before. I said, well, what is it that bothers you in particular about that? And she said, well, she said, they show that same clip over and over and over. And she said, I just know everybody in the country thinks I only have that one dress. Feel your pain. I'm going to stop and I'll come back and pick up kind of where I was, I think. I'll tell you that I was born in Wichita, Kansas. That's my home. September of 1938, so I'm right at 72 and a half, and I'm having trouble with that, except it's a big number. I got here too fast. And, the good DNA, I feel like I'm about half my age. I really do. I have no limitations, and I look around at my buddies my age, and they've got knee replacements and hip replacements, and they've got bad backs, and they've got other parts that are modified or medicated. And I always say, I still got all my parts, and they all work. And, of course, Barbara jumps in, and she goes, well, yeah, most of the time. And she knows this is an ego-deflating program, and that's her job, and she's very good at it. And she stays, she's 24-7 on that. But I just tell you how old I am because I know I'm not the only one who does it, but when I'm in, I get around to a lot of conventions and stuff over the course of the year. I'm always curious about how old the speaker is, and I'm always trying to figure it out. And usually I can before they're done because little things are said along the way, and I can put them together and puzzle it out. And I'm pretty close. But the women are really devious in AA, and I don't know if it's on purpose or what, but they very seldom they tell you. But they'll throw things out like, I graduated from college and I immediately go, well, I was about 22. The year after the Kennedy assassination, I'm going, when the hell was that? Was that 63 or 64? And then I had my first child, I was I just got married, and my first child, I was 26. It was a year after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. I was 68 or 69. And so I'm doing this back and forth and up and down, and by the time she's done, I'm looking at her, she walks off and go, she's either 45 or 68. I'm not sure. So I just tell you and get it all out of the way. I was born and I was raised in a very blue-collar place. It was an economically depressed area on the southeast edge of Wichita called Plainview. It was a World War II housing project, and it's where all the economically disadvantaged people lived, and it was I had a great time there. I loved it. I remember being happy. It was literally the 50s and the days of the happy days, and we didn't have any drugs, weren't very big then, very scant, and we didn't have any drive-by shootings, no gangs where I was at, and I remember being a happy kid with everybody else that lived there. It was a very diverse community. It was blacks and whites and Hispanics and small Native American segment. I was part of that Native American segment, and I'm an ethnic mix of several different things, and the only two that seem to cause any problems when I'm drinking are the Irish and Comanche parts, and they never want to miss a time at the bar when I'm there. And it was a good combination, I thought. I enjoyed the Irish music. I loved that highly spirited Irish music and the freedom songs and rebel songs and drinking songs. And I knew where those places were around the country. So I would head for those places when I was in Boston or Chicago or Washington, D.C. or any other places. I knew where those places were, and boom, I changed clothes and I was there and nothing flat. And I'd be sitting there singing along all those songs, just having a heck of a time, and I'd literally be the last guy out the door. And then there were other times, other places, when the other mood would kick in the other side, and maybe those places weren't available. And I would remember thinking, this would be a good night, just have a couple of drinks, go out and kill some white people. And that's not a good thing if it's in Billings, Montana, with all those cowboy bars. That's a challenge. I had grown up in the powwows and the songs and the dances. I was a dancer and active in that community. When I was 14, my parents had their first divorce. It was at that point in time the alcohol blew the family apart. It had been coming, but it blew it apart when I was 14, and I didn't know it was going to happen. And I was heavily affected by that, as was my sister, who was 2 years younger than I was. She later experienced a lot worse things than I had seen. But by the time I graduated from high school, which was 3 years later, I graduated when I was 17, I'd gone through four sets of step-parents. And I didn't like step-parents, and I didn't like step-brothers and step-sisters, and I wouldn't know any of them if they were in the room tonight. But I had trouble with them. I didn't play nice, and I didn't like them. And so I would get into some kind of a clash and be asked to go to the other family, and I'd bounce back and forth, and that's pretty much how I went through high school. And I had decided that when I graduated from high school that I was going to join service. I didn't know what yet. Most of my friends married their little high school sweethearts, and off they went to work in one of the aircraft factories there that Wichita was famous for and still is, that Boeing Beach Test and those other places. There were more there then, but I didn't want to do that. Didn't have a girlfriend anyway, so one of my buddies came back from the Marine Corps, and right from boot camp, and I was really impressed. And we sat in a bar for several hours and drank. And he, it was just one story after another coming out of him about what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits in boot camp. And these are brutal, sadistic stories, and I'm just hanging on every word. I'm just engrossed in this. And it's probably an early sign of not good thinking, because I remember saying, God, I just can't wait to go there and do that. And within days, I was 18 by this time, within days I found a recruiter, signed on the line, and off I went. A lot of stories I hear, most of the stories I hear, have a recurring theme in them, a couple of them, and mine does not. And that is that I never fit in. And you're not going to hear me say that, nor will you hear me tell you that the first time I had a drink of alcohol, I found what I was looking for. This is a progressive disease. And it took a while for it to actually kick into high gear with me, but I've got a good work ethic, so I'll stay with it. And once I got to boot camp, and once I got over the initial shock of that experience, I liked it. And it was exactly where I wanted to be. It was, for people, if there are Marines in the room, they know what I'm talking about. That is an experience that is incredibly difficult, extreme, and unique, and intense. And I really stamped into it, and I liked it. And I had never experienced anything like the camaraderie that I saw in there for the very first time ever. So I fit in, I belonged, I liked it, and that's where I was going to stay. I wanted to be a Marine, I was going to stay in there. That was what I was going to do. I am all throughout the course of my drinking, I was always in a heavy drinking environment. So it became, I fit into that a lot better. And it became a long time, it took a long time before I began to pull away from the crowd, and you could actually see things happening to me that were not happening around me with my friends. And I was a Marine, I was supposed to be able to drink hard, so I did. And so did my buddies. And 4.5 years later, I came walking in, I was doing really well. 4.5 years later, I came walking in, the commanding officer took me in the office and said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. They're the only guy in this entire unit who has entry scores that are high enough to go test for that. And I knew I had some high scores, didn't know how they got there, but I was happy about it, but it was a mystery to me. But and I'd always wanted to fly. And so all of a sudden, he's opening the door to this opportunity. And I went over and tested and passed. It was an all-day affair, and I passed. And he said, the other thing I need to tell you is about, this is an 18-month program, very fast-paced, and you're coming in, you're one of the few. As a matter of fact, I was the only one I knew who had no college, none. Not even 6 weeks of college. He said, you're going to be one of the few coming in from the enlisted side, the back door, and most of them, 98-99% coming in from the street side, all have to have 2 years college minimum to get into this program. There'll be roughly a 50% washout rate. And I immediately could see that I was on the high end probability-wise of not making it, because I was starting off way behind. Educationally, I had a big deficit if I was going to be operating with college people. And the other thing that concerned me was I thought about flying, but not in any kind of reality-based idea. And to me, the guys and the people that got to be pilots didn't come from where I came from. They didn't come from my background. They didn't come from native communities out of an alcoholic home in a World War II housing project. They came from places in Wichita called Eastboro, where the rich people lived, and other places in Wichita where the families that had some prestige, and those kids went to college, and they didn't come from, I was not like them. But I wanted to fly, and I said, okay. And I went home to Wichita as I got ready to go to Pensacola, and there was powwow, and I went out and danced. had grown up mostly with the Kiowa family after my parents' first divorce. Spent an awful lot of time with them. And so I went around the arena. They called for a special, and people came out and did what we do. And the next day, going to Pensacola, I thought, there's no way I can come back to this community and tell them I failed. I can't be the one guy that gets the opportunity to come back and says I didn't make it. So I was driven with that all the way through the entire 18 months. And there were four phases to flight training at that point in time. And through every one of those phases, I was the number two guy. That seemed to be my number. And the first time I was convinced it was an accident, administrative error, but I wasn't going to say anything. And throughout the rest of the time, I never believed I was as good as my grades seemed to indicate. I never got cocky or complacent or confident. I was watching my friends wash out every week, sometimes daily, and I remember the looks in their eyes. Their eyes were always down as they came over their sea bag over their shoulder saying goodbye. I'd never see them again, and their dreams of flying were gone. And I thought, one of these days, before the 18 months is over, they'll get me. That'll happen to me. The final 6 months, but I pushed hard. I really pushed hard. I got that from my parents. I got a good work ethic from my parents. I watched them. And the final 6 months, I left Florida and went to Texas for advanced jet flight training. The night I got there, I got drunk with a bunch of my buddies at the Officers Club. They said, let's go into town. There's an old-fashioned drive-in called Cane's. That's where the good-looking girls hang out. And South Texas has got some good-looking girls. And we had an inside edge because we had that marrying potential of being officers and fighter pilots and all this stuff. So I said, okay. And I was never really aggressive with the gals, but I went in and I had a lot to drink. And they immediately went after some girls. And I hung back and drank a little bit more, rehearsed some things. And those driver wasn't saying anything to anybody, so I rehearsed a few things. And when I drink, I'm sure it doesn't happen to you, but really wondrous things happen to me. I get wittier, quicker, clever, taller even. And so I came up with about three things I was going to go up there and say to the driver. And I was just so proud of myself for coming. I thought, man, I wouldn't be surprised if she's going to sit there when I pop these things. She'd probably just take her clothes right off. And so I walked up, and all geared up for this, and she turned and looked at me, and she was really good looking. And I forgot everything I was going to say. And I'm standing there, and I don't know where it went, but it left. And I'm thinking, she's looking at me with some degree of expectation, and I got to say something. And the only thing I thought of was she had the most beautiful brown eyes I'd ever seen. But it came out a little late in the evening with a lot of booze, like, that's a brown eyes. And she looked at me like I just whizzed on the side of her car, and I just turned around and walked away. And I've had a few drinking occasions, not many, but where I was so drunk that even I knew that I couldn't talk. And I thought, that's so bad. And you would think that when you get that drunk, you would not be capable of being embarrassed. I mean, that's the least God could do for me is let me get that drunk and not be embarrassed by it. And I was embarrassed. And I turned around and walked away, and I just I thought, that's it. I'm not going back. So I'm standing back there drinking, and a little while later, she gets out of the car to go into the ladies' room, and I got a really good look, and a nice look, a good look. And she had a really nice rear end. She was wearing turquoise shorts and had a nice shapely set of legs. And I thought, God darn, man, all that and brown eyes, that's a lot more than I had on my list. And I had an AA thought, but I didn't recognize it for about 29 more years, because as she walked in there, I looked at her and I thought, I really want what she has. I'm willing to go to any length to get it. And I did. And had an encounter with her accidental the next day. I was with a cadet buddy of mine and saw them go in there. We wheeled around, went in there. I was scared, but I was sober, and they let us buy them some coffee. We talked. She gave me her name, and she and I began to date. She was a terrific gal. I'd never met anybody like her before or since. And on February the 25th of 63, it all came to an end as I completed the flight training. And on that day, which was her 20th birthday, she pinned a set of gold wings over my heart. She pinned two gold bars on my shoulders. I was now a Marine second lieutenant. You know, that had been almost too big for me to dream. I'm now a designated fighter pilot, and I'm a commissioned Marine Corps officer after being an enlisted man. I mean, Hollywood couldn't have scripted a better day. And we drove north to Wichita for a three-week leave, and she stayed with my sister. I stayed with my dad, and he wasn't doing well at all. And as the leave was coming to an end, everybody loved her. Everybody that met her loved her. They always did. They still do. I called her and I said, we're running out of time. Let's go down to Oklahoma and get married. So we drove down to Newkirk, Oklahoma with a buddy of mine and his wife. They took the rings off, loaned us the rings, and we got married in front of a justice of peace. Some years later, they divorced, and we're still together. So rings apparently work for us. She joined me out in California. I joined one of what I consider one of the finest Marine squadrons ever put together, and we still have our reunions. I'll see those guys next month, April the 5th, out in San Diego. A Vietnam bunch, the ones that are still alive, we've lost a number and we along the way, but they are my comrades. And they were 28 of the finest pilots I've ever experienced in my life. And I look back and think, what a privilege and honor it was to fly with them. And Barbara was immediately pregnant, go figure. And we had a boy, a little boy. And 8 days, less than a year later, we had a second one. And people would come up and go, are you guys Catholic? I go, no, we're just a couple of horny Protestants. And we don't have any problem with this. And I left to go to Vietnam. We were one of the first Marine squadrons into the country, flying a little base called Chu Lai, 52 miles south of Da Nang. It was a very primitive setup, tents and sand and sea rations. We had no frills, no nothing. Runway was half as long as we needed, but we had carrier resting gear. We were all carrier qualified. Flying was extraordinarily challenging, really challenging. But we acquitted ourselves well over there. Just did very well. I put in for a regular commission, which would guarantee me a career in the Marine Corps, and they were very competitive. And I thought, even as I put in the paperwork, there is no way possible, not on this, it's just not going to happen. They will not give an officer a commission that has a high school education. That's for college people, usually college degrees. And I couldn't believe it. I got a regular commission. So I came back and I stayed in the Marine Corps for another 2.5 years, and finally got out because I was going to be gone for a total of 4 to 6 years with my family. My family had to come first, and Barbara and I talked about that. She had never pressured me to get out. So I put a letter in January or July of 68. I resigned and got out. I got in 11.5 years earlier as a barely 18-year-old kid out of high school. And I came out as a very seasoned senior Marine Corps captain with some personal decorations, a good reputation, and I'd had a good journey. And that's what I was supposed to do. That was the expectation for me, not to do what I did in Fargo that night. That wasn't what I was supposed to do. 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest. And for nearly 22 years there, I had the same kind of a career. I liked the people. I liked the flying. I loved the job. And I couldn't wait to go to work. Barbara and I talked about adopting a little child even before we got married. We had the two boys. And I said, let's either do it or quit talking about it. She wanted a daughter. So we've been in a hell of a battle. Up there in Minnesota is where we were living. In 14 months we fought for this little girl, and we got this little Indian girl who came back to our house when she was 17 days old. And it had been a struggle. And we had pushed and pursued and really persevered. And Barbara now had a daughter. But what I didn't know, of course, was what daughters do to their dads. And I had my two rough and tumble boys, but I'll tell you, that little girl absolutely stole my heart. She became the center of my universe. And I just loved her so much. And, she couldn't walk past me without me saying, Dawn, come over here and give me a hug. And I'd pick her up, put my arms around her, look in that little beautiful little face, and I'd say, thank you for being my girl. She'd say, thanks for being my dad. We were very open about the adoption, and she knew she was adopted, but that was only a word. It's only a word now. She couldn't have been my girl anymore than if Barbara had given birth to her. I came home one night from a trip. Barbara was different. I saw something. She said, Dawn came up to me today. She was in the second grade. Apparently, she said they were talking about babies. And she said, Mama, did I grow in your tummy? Barbara said, no. Honey, she said, you grew in my heart. And it affected me as much then as it did right now. And I thought, what an answer. And that it was, in fact, where she had grown. And my drinking was picking up, but I wasn't having serious problems. Now, when I got in treatment and I did a first step look back and I started putting things down on paper, I saw many, many, many indications of where I was headed. But I did not, as they were occurring, because I wasn't having car accidents and killing people or hurting people or having serious consequences. I was having things happen, but they weren't really affecting me. I saw it when I got in treatment, but I didn't see it then. And when Don was about 17 and coming up on high school graduation, I had decided to finally, I passed up being a captain for 2 years because I wanted to be home with her. And one afternoon I said, it's time for me to go to Chicago and take a special test, put my card in to be a captain. Don knew I was going to Chicago that afternoon. She and some of her friends came over and got what they wanted, left a runaway note, and Barbara found it late that night and couldn't call me. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I have no idea what triggered that, why. Don't know if I would have seen it if I hadn't been drinking. I just don't know. Things happen in other families also. So I don't know. I don't deny it. I just don't know. I called home the next day, discovered that she'd run away, and I panicked, and I blurted out to Barbara where to go, who to call, where to look. I got on the airplane in Chicago. I was home in 2 hours. I was scared. I'd lost my little girl. I was scared to death. But somewhere on that flight home, and I don't know how, when, where, or why, something happened to me. You know, I didn't feel it happening, but it happened. And when I got off the airplane, I hated her. I hated her worse than I thought I had the capacity to hate anyone or anything. And I told Barbara, I said, I don't care if she dies in the streets. She will never come back to my house, ever. Never be allowed back in that home. And I told the rest of the family that. Never mentioned her name to me, ever, in my presence. Within 2 days, everything she'd ever owned in that house was gone to Goodwill. There was no evidence she'd ever been in my home. I went to the bank and I ripped up her adoption papers. I went to an attorney and gave him $500 and disowned her. And I tried to annul the adoption. I couldn't. In the midst of this raging insanity, in the way only an alcoholic can do it, I looked around and thought, you know, I don't think Barbara's handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. I got the yellow pages, and I, by the luck of the draw, plucked a name out, PhD family therapist, and he was a good one. By the luck of the draw, I got a good one. We saw him about twice a month for 2 years. Never talked about drinking, which I find phenomenal, because I am not talking about my drinking. I talked about it with any of you. I didn't have a problem. So I didn't shy away from talking about it. It never came up. And I didn't like talking about my daughter. And one day we were involved in a session and something came up about it. And I made a statement that I'd never consciously formed in my mind, but boy, it said it painted me completely. And I looked at the doctor and I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I said, I would rather hate than hurt. And that portrayed me perfectly. And that's what I did. He said, you did it during your childhood and you survived doing that. But he said, if you continue, it'll destroy you. And everything he said to us was true. It just took a while for me to actually see it happen and for it to prove out. And thanks, Tim. And but that's what I did. I would not let anybody hurt me because I get angry. And when I throw the anger up, the pain can't come through. It can't. I'll block it with that. And I got good at it, real good at it. And I thought, and he said, now comes this girl. And he said, it's going to take an awful lot of hatred, Lyle. And I thought, I can do it. I can do this. And that's pretty much where we were at the time of the arrest. I didn't drink in the house because Barbara asked me not to. Because I'd say things about Dawn, even though I said, don't anybody do that. And it hurt her. It really hurt her bad. And so I said, I'll drink on the road. So I did. And I was a solitary drinker. I knew where the liquor stores were, how long it took me to get there. And I wouldn't go to the cruise anymore. I would lock my door. I'd turn the TV on. And I'd sit there with a quart of booze. And I can go through that pretty quick. And if somebody called, a crew member called, would answer the phone. If they knocked on the door, wouldn't go to the door. I sat and drank. The cruel thing about where my alcoholism was at this point was I couldn't get the relief I wanted. I know what the first drink does because I mix them stiff. I mix them really stiff. And before that second hand goes all the way around, I feel it. I've got what I'm after. The warmth and that glow and that just spreading all over my body. That floating away, that it's not so bad and I don't really care now. It's okay. It isn't as bad as I thought it was. And that relief that I always get. It may be short-lived, but it's relief. And I couldn't get that anymore. It never worked for me from that point on. But I had in the bottle, might as well have been gasoline, I might as well have been pouring it on the fire, because all I got was more hatred, more anger, more self-pity, more martyrdom. Look what I'd done for her, look how she'd repaid me, and I just did this over and over and over, and every time it was bigger and bigger and bigger, and I was exhausted. I was absolutely exhausted by the time this arrest came about. I went into treatment. I didn't want anybody to know who I was or what I was. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes. I would not look up. I couldn't look up. I sat everywhere with my head down. So ashamed. I didn't want anybody to talk to me. And within a couple of days, the media had it and everybody knew. The good thing was I was so beaten and so devastated that I bought into this deal. I didn't fight it. I didn't know if it worked or not, but I had to bet on it. I had to invest in it, and I invested heavily. A week of the day that I went into treatment, I wouldn't go near either one of the two TV sets in the hospital, but patients feel that they've designated duties can report, and they do. And so I knew that a week to the day, TV had announced that I was fired from Northwest, and that was fair and appropriate. They also announced that the FAA had performed emergency revocation of my licenses. That was fair and appropriate, and I lost my FAA medical certificate because of my alcoholism. Again, fair and appropriate. I'm a hardcore believer and acceptance of personal responsibility and being accountable. The tragedy of alcoholism, in my view, is that I'm not the one that takes the beating. I deserve the beating. I deserved everything that came my way. But I brought it to my family. I brought it to the people who love me. I brought it to everyone who cared anything about me. They got to share in this, and they didn't deserve it. I walked into a group therapy session one day. They closed the door and there were 8 or 10 of us in there. I don't know why I talked, because it was counterintuitive. But for some reason I started talking about my daughter. And for the first time ever, I didn't have that wall of anger up. And I broke down and cried. I hadn't cried at my parents' funerals. They both died from this disease, and I've been to the funeral. I just didn't cry. The pain just ripped my heart out of my chest, and I sat there and sobbed about my daughter. Never done that before. That was one of my greatest moments in treatment. Hadn't got anything to do with how tough I am or how tough I'm not. For the first time ever, I took the pain like I was supposed to, straight on. And it hurt. And I think I began to heal on that day. It was a massive movement for me. No visitors, no phone calls in this treatment center. And they said, I wrote to Barbara and told her, I said, get a hold of Donna, let's put the family back together again. They said, that's such an impossible breakthrough for you. We'll let you have a day room to do that if you can get her up here. And a few days later, the two doctors heard about it. And they said, could we please come watch? And so a few days later, I walked into a day room. And I saw the two doctors over to the left. And I looked halfway across the room, was my little girl. And I thought, God, I don't remember her being that small. I had seen her for 2 years. And I walked over, and I have to tell you, it was one of the most amazing moments in my life to put my arms around this girl that I had spent 2 years hating and telling her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And I looked down in her arms, and there was a 5-month-old granddaughter. And she took my heart as quickly as my daughter had. My daughter got married. I didn't even know her last name. First week or so of treatment, I'm already getting to see the promises come true, and I'm not even yet aware of that in the midst of this disaster that's still unfolding. Suddenly, we began to get word of legal consequences. Nobody knew anything about that on the day of the arrest. None of the attorneys did. And I went through 6 legal crises there in the treatment center. And each time they came to me 2 or 3 days after the event, it was worse. The penalties had doubled. And it would stop my heart. I couldn't breathe. It was like the air in the room had gone out. And it would take me several days to settle in. And then they would do it again and again and again. And finally I stepped outside and there was a doctor. And I thought, oh my God. We went down to the doctor's office with my counselor. And he said, sit down. I have to tell you, there's a federal grand jury that has indicted you. You're now looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday and wants $50,000. We went broke in the first 30 days. I'm now back to where I had always been before I enjoyed this level of success, and I'd taken my family there with me also. And I said, he said, I can't afford it, and I can't do it. He said, I have to ask if you're going to hurt yourself. And I said, no, I won't. I went back to my room and I collapsed, and I don't remember falling, but I remember lying on the carpet. I was crying again, and I said, God, please help me. I can't do this even one more time. I just don't have anything left, not even one more time. I can't. And I remember sleeping that night. I had many things happen to me in treatment, life-changing things that I don't have time to go into. I got out of treatment, and I had really built hard on this 12-step thing. I wasn't out in the rec room with the rest of the patients because that's where the TV was. And I was in my room, and I read, and I read, and I read, and I went over it and over it and over it, and I worked hard on this stuff. And I was up there in Minnesota. I was quickly in a heavily publicized three-week trial. I'm seeing my picture sketched on TV on the six plungies. That was things that happened to you. Not, they don't happen to me. And there I am. There I am. But I had an advantage because I was the alcoholic in the bunch, and I could go to AA meetings. And I only had 4.5 months sobriety, but I'd worked hard, and I had something, and I had more than they had. And I would walk into this group of reporters. There was no way to go, well, they didn't have the routes covered. And I would be terrified, and I'd start to mantra the serenity prayer as many times as I could before I approached the group. I could feel just some lessening in there. It didn't go away, but I could feel some lessening in there, and I'd get through it as they're sticking microphones and cameras in front of me, wanting a reaction, and I wouldn't give it to them. I had an amazing story with an attorney I don't have time to go into, and I told him, I said, I'll be found guilty, so don't worry, I'll be okay, I can handle it. And we went back, the jury went out, came back very quickly, and I knew what that meant. I was the captain, so everything came to me first. They announced guilty. And I saw him stiff, and I reached over and patted him. I said, it's okay, Peter, it's all right. Went back a few months later for the sentencing, a couple of months later for the sentencing. Guidelines were in place, and it was going to get 18 months. That had been algebraically figured out. And I was a captain, I knew I was going to get 18 months. And then a day and a half before sentencing, the judge, on his own, not asked for by the prosecutor, announced to everybody he was going to depart upward from the guidelines. My attorney said he can go all the way to 15 years. And the judge had strong feelings about this case, and I'd seen that every day during the trial. I read it, and he was entitled to those feelings. I didn't begrudge him that. And so I told Barbara, this is step one issue all over again. I'm powerless over what's going to happen. This is a matter of acceptance. I've got to accept what comes. This is going to be big, and I don't know what it's going to be. And on the morning of sentencing, as I stood to make my statement, I'd been in treatment with a federal judge, and he told me a lot of stuff. And he said, the sentencing's a charade. He said, even though you're going to talk, your attorney may talk, he said, that sentence stays the same. When we come through the door, it's set. He said, we never change from the bench. And there have been other judges and attorneys around the country that have told me that's so. That's true. So I knew nothing was going to change. He was going to do what he was going to do. And as I stood to speak, I was so scared, I still didn't know what I was going to say. And I talked about being grateful to be sober, grateful for what had happened inside my family, and the fact that I had accepted responsibility for this from day one. I couldn't change what was going to happen. He announced a sentence on me of 16 months. It blew everyone. He told the media this, too, so they were anticipating big, big stuff. And it blew everybody away. Several years later, he told my attorney in chambers, he said, I was going to sentence him to 4 years in prison until he said what he said, until I looked at him and thought more about him as a human. And I came down from the bench. A miracle happened that day in the courtroom. The other thing that had happened was I told my kids, I said, be prepared to see me locked up in handcuffs on TV and paraded into prison because of the publicity. But he said, this is a very complex case. It's the first time anyone has ever been tried under this law that came on the books in 87. And I know there'll be appeals, and I'll let you remain free until the appeals have made their way. The other two said, okay. I said, no, I'll go to prison. Because I learned it here. Everything I have done in here, done in this story, is what I learned in here. A lot of I's and me's in a first-person story. It was never about I or me. It was about us. You and me and we. And what you taught me and what I was forced to learn in here. That's what it's about. And I said, this was about life on life's terms. And I said, I'll go to prison now. I've been convicted. I'll go now. He told my attorney, he said, I've never had a defendant do that before since. He said, I was lost for words when he said that. And I told my attorney, I said, well, wasn't lost very long. So on December the 5th, 1990, 34 years to the day that I walked into Marine boot camp, walked into the Atlanta federal prison system there. I had a lot of things happen during the time I was there, and I don't ever talk about those from the podium. Audiences love to hear that stuff. I don't talk about it because it hasn't got anything to do with my recovery. My recovery has everything to do with how I handle the things in prison, the people, the situations, and the circumstances in prison. And so I just don't talk about it from the podium. And I came out. That was the most notorious. Oh, the judge put sanctions, additional sanctions on me, heavy sanctions, because he was going to make sure that I never flew again. On top of everything the FAA did, he guaranteed that I would never see the inside of a cockpit again. And I came out of prison. I was broke. I was notorious. Everybody knew about me, knew about the Northwest Flight 650 incident. The judge had put sanctions on me. And a year later, we went back to him and he lifted the sanctions. Nobody thought that was possible. Nobody thought that was possible from this judge. Toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District. He pulled the sanctions, and there's a long story to that. I can't go into it. But the FAA said, as I checked with them, they said, if you want to fly again, you start again from the bottom with a private license. Now, one of my pilot buddies thought that was possible. I'd never had a private license. I'd come out of the Marine Corps and been given a commercial license with an instrument rating. And I didn't think it was possible at first, but I thought, everything, how do I do anything in here? How do I stay sober one day at a time? Why don't I think about these four licenses in terms of one license at a time and choke this down where it's bite-sized? 10.5 months later, I had four licenses in my pocket through nothing but one day at a time, hard work stuff. But there's a flying thing that goes into play, and I didn't have the money for that, $10,000, $20,000. I was working in the same treatment center, Anchor Hospital, counseling department. I was making $14,000 a year, just barely staying alive. I couldn't do that. And a pilot at Northwest gets a hold of me. He said, you didn't know I had a flight school, but I want you to come back up to Minnesota and live with me and my family, go through the flight school free. So I went back up there, checked in with the Department of Corrections in Minnesota, and spent 44 days up there with that man and his family. Had amazing experiences, and I'm going to AA everywhere I go and really enjoying it. AA has just been the backbone of this whole thing. And I was rained out 14 days, flew 78 hours in the other 30 days, and got four licenses back. I had two of them by 11:15 one morning. Don't think I'd ever been done before. I came back, and I thought, that's great, but nobody will hire me. Not anybody in this country. Nobody. And a month later, the licenses physically arrived in the mail, and I got a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. The grievance had been filed automatically, and I hadn't activated. And I said they were justified in terminating me. They didn't fire me for being an alcoholic. They fired me for what I did, and that was fair. He said, this is the best phone call I've ever made, because he said 3 hours ago, John Dasburg, who is the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, himself made a personal decision to bring you back and put you into full flight status at Northwest. And I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't believe that level of courage was beyond extraordinary. What happened if I relapsed? He had just sacrificed his career for faulty judgment and allowing me to do it a second time. He risked his entire career gambling on me. So I went back to Northwest, signed a back-to-work agreement, never to be a captain again, but I was so grateful to be back. At least I was going to have something in the way of retirement. So for the next 5 years, not quite, I dedicated myself to doing the best job possible so that nobody ever had a chance to regret bringing me back. Anybody who had ever risked that belief in bringing me back, I wanted to leave with them vindicated. As I approached my final year at Northwest, I was speaking to United Airlines. I get another phone call at night, and it's the same pilot, and he said, Dasburg exchanged his mind. He thinks for your last year at Northwest, you need to be a 747 captain. The promises kept coming true, and all I did was keep staying sober. That's all. So I went back, and I checked out, and I wrapped up my career at Northwest honorably, with dignity, having been given back everything, flying all over the world in the left seat of a 747 in charge of a crew of 18 and 400 passengers because I'm a sober member of AA, completely restored. As I retired honorably in September of 98 at the mandatory age of 60, my lawyer called me within a couple of days. He said, Judge Rosenbaum just called me. He said, in 16 years on the federal bench, he's never supported a petition for pardon, 8 years after the trial. And he said, he'll support yours if you want to make the attempt. So I put the paperwork in. He wrote a chokingly powerful 3-page affidavit that brings tears to my eyes every time I read it. And 2 years later, I came walking in, and there were 8 phone messages telling me I had just received a presidential pardon. That is a life-changing event for someone with a federal felony conviction. Second day in treatment, I was at Clarkston. They had an outside AA meeting. I had my head down naturally, wasn't looking at anybody, and they started to read the promises like they did here tonight. And I thought, what are the chances? Maybe there's something to it. And then they hit that part that said, no matter how far down the scale, that's it. That lets me out. That may be true for you, it will never be true for me. It can't. And you've not heard 70% of the story. I've talked 63 minutes now, and you've not heard 70% of the story. I'm going to close. I'm going to do something that I heard Father Martin do one time. He stole it from somebody on a card, so I guess it's fair that I take it from him. And I'm not trying to be Father Martin. I just love the way it sounds. So. And it just says simply this: I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you strength and faith and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic, and I thank you for my sobriety and for allowing me to be here tonight with you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lyle. That was beautiful. And we are going to wrap things up as quick as we can. Anybody that came in after we passed the basket early that would like to contribute, we've got a basket up here. We've got two baskets by the door on the way out. And time for AA-related announcements. I'm going to launch into the first one. I understand there's a ladies' workshop maybe coming up also, but there's a men's workshop at Rock Eagle, March 25th through the 27th. We can still squeeze you in if you haven't signed up. And I think they got some leftover hats, and they're pretty nice. And it's a heck of a place to work the 12 steps, man on man. And what else we got? You got something, Frank? Okay. Howard's going to give out the chips. All the
way back. Hi, I'm Howard. I'm an alcoholic. Here at the Monday night, 8 p.m., Blue Chip Speakers Meeting, we have a chip system to mark your time. It's Friday. The first chip we offer is a white chip. If you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, want to come in, try our way of life for 24 hours, come on up and get it. Anybody else for a white chip? Next chip we offer is a silver chip for 30 days and 30 nights of sobriety. Anybody want to pick up a silver chip? Next chip, red chip, 3 months. Next chip's a gold chip. That's for 6 months, because there's nothing yellow about being sober for 6 months. Yeah. hope we run out of chips. Next chip is a green chip. Green chip. 9 months. Anybody? Are there any birthdays that we don't know about? Birthdays or multiples thereof? Okay, thank God for the chips you hold.
Thank you, Alan. We got a special birthday, Lowell. My name is Lowell, and I am an alcoholic. 21 years ago, I was in a recovery group, Vietnam Veterans Counseling Service, and while I was there, there was a guy come in. He was all pretty well shook up, and he come in, and it was a while before I realized who he was. You know, I remembered all about it, but you know, he come in anonymous and stayed that way, and slowly but surely, over the time, the story came out in the group, and I got to know Lyle then. And I just keep running into him, damn it. Yeah, you know, I've run into him all different kind of places across the state. And he's the only one that I remember out of our group that I keep running into. I've never seen anybody else, but at least there was two of us. And he's been an inspiration in my life, and I want to let him know that, man, I love you.
Thanks, man. Thank you so much for this. That was a good group. Lowell is the only one that I know of that I finally left the group because they were talking too much about being Vietnam vets, and that if you weren't a Vietnam vet, you really didn't understand what we were going through. And I said, I'm just an alcoholic, and the same 12 steps works for me, it works for others. I love the group, but I really had to leave as a result of that. And I was in the prison halfway house just up the street from that. I had to fight to get to that meeting. They didn't want to let me go down there. So thanks for being here, Lowell, and thanks for giving me my chip.
Okay, any other business? Okay, anybody going to take a drink tonight? Raise your hand if you're going to take a drink. Okay, well, then give yourself a hand. Okay, if anybody's got any energy to help us put the room back together, Howard raising his hand is going to help out, and Bert in the green shirt, Charles in the orange shirt, Tim in the black coat. We'll be grateful for any help you give us. So, without any further, let me remind you, everybody, that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer. M.H., you please take us out, sir.
Put it silent. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom,